Welcome to Ida History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right, you're listening to Ida History, the podcast. I'm Jeff Wade, sitting right across the table from Mr. Mark Iverson. Mark, what's up?
My spirits.
Your spirits.
My excitement for this episode.
Ooh, this is an exciting episode, but you know, Mark, we got a busy day tomorrow. Why don't you tell listeners what we're up to tomorrow?
Well, being men of Idaho, we are going to educate my alma mater. Jeff, was it your alma mater?
No.
Boise State Broncos History Department. We're going to go there and talk to a class about, researching and writing these stories that we come up with, especially those tied to crime.
Yeah.
And then we are going that evening to the museum, the state. They don't say history. They just say the state museum. But the state history museum.
I think the history's implied, isn't it?
I guess. Wow. But, we're going to go to an event in their Owyhee room with a great bar, bar, and then the old, atrium, what do they call that? Dome from the Owyhee Hotel.
Oh, yeah, up above there.
Yeah, which is no longer there.
Yeah.
The dome, obviously. Yeah. And so we're going to have sort of a meet and greet with students, ask us questions, present ourselves to.
About the Working History Showcase?
Yes. That's what it's called? Yeah.
Yeah, so we did that last year, and it was a lot of fun. So,
yeah.
Obviously, that's tomorrow in real time. By the time this episode comes out, it'll be like 2 weeks ago. But
yeah. But we met Bill Manning at that one and got a little spot on PBS.
Yeah, that was true. Hopefully, he's there tomorrow. It'd be cool to see him.
Yeah.
All right, Mark. This story, like I said, it's a good one. So why don't you give us a little taste of what that's about?
So, first off, there's a lot going on in this story, which is what we like, of course. And we will talk about horse theft.
Ooh.
The old Idaho territorial/state penitentiary.
Always a good subject.
Always great. The Indian schools, as they were called.
Ooh.
And some confusing genealogical records, as well as we're going to throw in a little lynching. For good measure.
Did you say lynching, Mark?
Lynching. I said lynching.
Ooh.
So, not sure that we'll always be able to offer trigger warnings, but we will be talking about two very sad cases of domestic violence in this episode. So
yes, we will.
Do turn it off if you think you wouldn't like to hear that, this story.
Just heads up. So the subject of this episode is a guy named Peter Malik, and he was a member of the Nez Perce tribe. And he's also often referred to as a half-breed because one of his parents, I think his father might have been part French. His father was Peter Chandel Malik. And it's kind of confusing because they're both Peter. So I'm going to say Peter Sr., Peter Jr., maybe to help differentiate that. But there's not much information on Peter Sr., other than what I can find on Find a Grave, which, well, Mark, we're always on Find a Grave, right?
We love it.
I think you're on there today sending me links.
Picks up your spirit every time.
Sure does.
You want to feel better about things, go to Find a Grave, I tell you what.
Yeah, so, the information on there a lot of times is about as good as Wikipedia, which isn't saying much. So take it with a grain of salt if you're perusing that website.
Yeah, it's more of like a good place to start.
Yes.
And then investigate further to make sure what you've read is correct.
Yeah. But in this case, like I said, I couldn't find much outside of Find a Grave, so I'm going to present to you what it says. So Peter Sr., on his Find a Grave, has the text of a newspaper article, which makes it sound like he was a civilian scout for the Army during the Nez Perce War, which was 1877, Mark?
Yes.
Yes, 1877. So I found his name on a muster roll for a volunteer infantry company, which formed at Mount Idaho on June 15th, 1877. He might have also been an attorney, but his name is definitely listed on several land transfers up into the 1880s, which is pretty common with people who had money back then. They were always buying and selling land, right?
Yeah. And then other things after they made it well off of that, right?
That's right. Sheep. stuff like that.
Yeah. Lots of sheep.
So I don't know where he's going with that. There's also a Malik mining district up near Warren, which I guess was probably named for him. But anyway, Peter Sr.'s parents are listed on Find a Grave as Abigail, who was born in New York, and George, who was born in Pennsylvania. Abigail's obituary has details of each of her children, including Peter Sr. So it says, son Peter Schindel married a 15-year-old girl named Sarah M. Armstrong. They had two children. Two died young, and she died at 19. Sorry, say that again. They had two children who died young, and she died at 19. He later remarried a Nez Perce Indian woman and had at least one son with her. And that son was, and I'm going to stop there because it's kind of a spoiler for the rest of the story. We don't want to spoil things yet, Mark. But those details line up with what we know, or what I know, we know of that son. Doing a little more digging, I found a marriage record for Peter Sr. with his wife being listed as an Elizabeth Fairfield. But she didn't have Peter Sr.'s son, Peter Jr., listed as her son anywhere. I traced his father's line as far back as I could, and that only took me to Pennsylvania in the mid-1700s, so I have no idea where the French thing actually comes from. So this is, you know, all probably kind of confusing, but long and short of it, it seems Peter Jr. was the son of a white man and Nez Perce woman. Anyway, Mark, why don't you tell us what we know about Peter Jr.?
Repeat. Just kidding. We know Peter Malik was born John Peter Malik in Grangeville, Idaho on January 21st, 1881.
Oh, I forgot to mention that this is our first episode dealing with North Idaho.
North Idaho.
Hi, North Idaho.
Moisture in the air. Totally different from down here.
That's true. They have trees.
They have trees. That's where my in-laws live.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. The Great Lake Pend'Oreille, as I used to say, or people used to say when they first moved into the state, Pandoria. People are like, oh, of course it's Pend'Oreille. It's like, well, you wouldn't know that
right
if you hadn't lived here your whole life. Or you speak French, I guess, whatever.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. But Peter would list his occupation as a farmer on the census and other government records. So it's likely his life or his early life was where he got this experience. The first time Malik is mentioned in the newspaper is on May 25th, 1900. Malik and his friend Joseph Bonaparte from the Flathead tribe of Montana, his father was Nez Perce, were arrested for stealing a horse. Malik and Bonaparte were arrested by the Flathead agency by the Nez Perce Indian agent and taken to Lewiston to be held for trial. From there, the suspects claimed they had taken the horse from a man who owed Malik some money, and the horse was a payment on a debt.
I don't know about you, Mark, but I don't take horses for my debts.
I don't mess with a man's horse. Furthermore,
well, that's true.
I don't mess with a woman's horse.
That's probably a good idea.
How about because a child's horse? Because I am a pretty progressive male.
Okay. Yeah, they're actually kind of lucky not to get shot.
I don't even take a pony or a mule.
Oh.
Not an ass. I don't take a man's ass.
Okay, don't take a man's ass, Mark.
Okay, thank you.
So Malik and Bonaparte were listed on the same residence on the 1900 federal census, and that was at 839 Main Street in Lewiston. Now, Mark, you know how on the census records it says, it has like a box that says relationship to head of household. Yeah. So for these two fellas, their relation to the house of the head of household reads prisoner. I've never seen that before.
Yeah, that's kind of a funny, I guess. I've never seen it before, I guess.
Yeah. It's not like funny, haha.
Yeah.
Yeah. But guess what the head of household's occupation was listed as, Mark?
Pimp.
No, it was grocer.
Whoa.
So apparently they were being held prisoner by a grocer.
Jeez.
But I don't know. I don't know how to explain that one. So.
I don't know. I guess it makes sense. You have storage space for your
goods and
maybe an ice house.
Or maybe the sheriff was a grocer in his full-time job.
Oh.
Something like that.
Maybe.
I don't know.
But whatever it was, Jeff, the next stop for Malik and Bonaparte was a long ride from Lewiston to Boise for a stay at the old Idaho penitentiary for grand larceny. They entered the prison on October 11th, 1900. John Bonaparte was given the number 781, and Peter Malik was given 783. Somehow, some other dude, also convicted of larceny in Nez Perce County, snuck in there between them at 782. He must have come in right before, I don't know, the same time.
Yeah.
But Malik and Bonaparte were both given 18-month sentences for a horse theft. Malik's entry paperwork notes that his father died when he was 18 and his mother when he was 5. As a closest relative, it lists a second cousin named Mary Maxwell at Fort Lapwai.
Mark, did you look at that picture I sent you of Peter Malik?
Yeah, but I totally don't recall what it looks like.
Let's check him out here so we know who we're talking about. All right. So, yeah, I'll post a picture of Mr. Malik with our episode, but we got a picture of him from the old pen wearing his prison number at 783. And, yeah, there he is.
He looks like a striking chap.
He looks pretty strong.
Yeah. Right? I wouldn't mess with him. He's got a fearsome look there.
That's right. All right. So the convicts were released from the old pen on February 10th, 1902, which is like, you know, 18 months after they went in. So they served their whole time, which is kind of surprising for the time period.
They're dead to society.
That's right. So they probably went back to their respective Indian agencies for a little while. However, it seems that Peter wanted to learn, or, you know, someone else wanted Peter to learn a new trade. So on November 23rd, 1904, Peter found himself on the other side of the United States in a place called the Carlisle Indian Industrial School. Mark, can you tell us about this place?
Why, yes, Jeff, I can.
Thank you.
And I will.
Excellent.
Opened in 1879 in Pennsylvania, the Carlisle Indian Industrial School was the first government-run boarding school for Native Americans. Civil War veteran Lieutenant Colonel Richard Henry Pratt spearheaded the effort to create an off-reservation boarding school with the goal of forced assimilation. The Army transferred Carlisle Barracks, which was a military post not in regular use, to the Bureau of Indian Affairs to be used as a boarding school. Students were basically forced to cut their hair, change their names, stop speaking their native language, convert to Christianity, and endure harsh discipline, including corporal punishment and solitary confinement. This approach was ultimately used by hundreds of other Native American boarding schools, some operated by the government and many more operated by churches. Pratt, like many others at that time, believed the only hope for Native Americans and their survival was to shed all Native culture and customs and to assimilate fully into white American culture. His common refrain was, kill the Indian, save the man. So we kind of call that cultural genocide nowadays. Yet initial student recruitment for the school was also about control of the tribes. The Department of War directed Pratt to travel to the Dakota Territory and recruit the first students from the Oglala Sioux and Brule Sioux. Government leaders essentially held hostage the children of tribal leaders to try to ensure good behavior of the tribes. The school was presented to the tribes as an opportunity for the children to learn English and be better able to protect the tribe's interests in the future. Many parents of tribal leaders initially embraced the opportunity for their children to learn, while others remained skeptical of any efforts by the United States government. And this is straight from the Carlisle School. It's now a historical interpretive site and has historians working there. Great website, but this is straight from their website. And I also know that many of the kids contracted diseases, especially tuberculosis, which we'll talk about in future episodes. But yeah, a lot of those kids died.
One of the messed up things I read, Mark, and I was actually going through the archives because they have their website. It's like the Carlisle School Project or something. It's like an interpretive project. But they have all their archives on another different website. You can Google that and find it. But this one letter I found, basically they were wanting to send a child named James Henry back to the Nez Perce Reservation after he had contracted tuberculosis at the school. So basically, this kid goes to the school, he gets tuberculosis, and they ship him back to the Nez Perce Reservation. And the whole world at this point knows what, you know, infectious disease, like living through a pandemic is like, you know, here in 2023. We've all lived through that.
Well, and I believe by this point, 1909, they knew about how TB was spread.
Yeah.
From mucus and coughing. I think they found that out, what, turn of the century, 1890s?
But there was, you know, thought a long time before that, that it was spread, you know, person-to-person contact. So it wasn't a secret, it wasn't a mystery that you could get TB from another person. So it's like, okay, so now we're just shipping disease around the country.
At once they thought it was, at one point earlier on, they thought it was like genetically passed down. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Yeah. And like I said, we're going to talk more about TB in Idaho probably in our next episode, right?
Yeah. We got a lot. We have a few future episodes that'll focus on tuberculosis wards. That's true, yeah. Treatment.
But like I said, Mark, Peter entered the Carlisle School in November of 1904, and whether he was willing to be there or not, I can't say. I feel like most kids that went there were not willing, but maybe, like you said, some were. So his entry record into the school reflects that he was there to learn a new trade, which was blacksmithing. It lists him as having a fourth grade education and leaving with a fifth grade education.
Well, speaking of leaving, Peter was supposed to be at the school for 5 years, but was expelled for bad behavior after only 10 months. Probably saved his life. Very well could have.
Could have, yeah.
The records aren't specific about what kind of bad behavior it was, but for a man who had spent 18 months in the Idaho State Pen, the Carlisle School was probably not the best place for him. So once again, he boarded a train and headed back home. Despite not graduating from Carlisle, Peter received a letter from the school with a sort of exit survey attached.
Yeah. So I'm going to go and read some of his answers and part of the letter that he returned to the school. But I'm going to go and skip the first question on here, in which we're going to come back to, Mark. So let's stick a pin in survey question number one. All right. So question number two, Mark. What is your present address? He writes, Grangeville, Idaho. Number three, did you attend or graduate from any other schools after leaving Carlisle? No, nor did I graduate from Carlisle. What is your present occupation? Salary? Endeavoring to farm. Salary is rather doubtful.
Oh, sounds like my job. Look there.
Yeah. Do you own your own home? He writes, indeed. What kind of house is it? Number of rooms? And I think he writes box. This is such a thing of a box house, right? That's a thing, right? Okay.
It's circular.
It's like the cracker box house.
Yeah, I don't know. Right? Like your basic farm-esque house?
Farmhouse, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably square. Number of rooms? 4 rooms. So decent sized house. How much property do you possess? And this has a line for stock. It says 4 workhorses, 1 calf, 2 Jersey cows, and a calf. And under land, he writes that he has 230 acres, which I run myself. Nothing under real estate. Jump in if you want to say anything.
Oh,
you look like you want to say something. So number eight, do you have money in the bank? And then there's like a line that's empty and it says how much? And he writes in there, have had, but none at present. And then it says, have you been in the Indian service? And he writes, no. What other positions have you held since leaving Carlisle? He says, none. And then this This is a good one right here. So it says, have you done anything for the betterment of your people? It says, write fully. And there's a lot of lines here. So it says, he writes, grown a mustache.
Well, I mean, that's a boon to any society.
Of course. I wish I could grow one.
Tried.
So, he says, grown a mustache and gone to farming. I do most earnestly believe if my example regards farming is worthy of imitation, it is the greatest step toward the betterment of this in general. I'm sorry. Again, this is a cursive handwriting, which is kind of hard to read.
Damn selfish people back then, right? Yep. In that cursive.
Man, I can read cursive. I can write cursive, but sometimes it's difficult to read.
I can squiggle my writing, I guess, if that's cursive. Yeah.
Yeah. Just connect all the letters together. That's all you got to do.
Yeah, it's been a while, but...
Yeah. Anyway, so he says, grown a mustache and gone to farming. I do most earnestly believe that if my example regards farming is worthy of imitation, it is the greatest step toward the betterment of my tribe in general. From the fact that very nearly all rent their land for cash rent, recovering about 1/12 of the production of their respective allotments. While on the other hand, if they could be prevailed upon with if they could be prevailed upon to farm their land, they would soon arrive at the conclusion that it is very pleasant and profitable vocation, as it is most. And he kind of trails off there, but basically, Mark, what he's talking about is there was a land act that gave permission for, we talked about this a little bit the other day. I think it was 18. I can't remember what year it was. Anyway, so this land act
allowed 70 something, wasn't it?
Something. Yeah. Anyway, so it allowed, it was called the Dawes Act, and the Dawes Act allowed natives to basically buy a portion of land in exchange for basically giving up their citizenship. No. So they gave up their membership in the tribe and then became a citizen of the United States, right? So it's another kind of step toward the assimilation of these people into the United States.
Well, that sounded like the pitch perfect answer for the government.
Yes.
Like, I'm just, you know, being a good member of my tribe and an American.
But how do you think it really worked out for most people?
Oh, I think they got a lot of their land taken from them. In fact, I know they did.
So a lot of them turned around and just sold that land outright. But what the point that Peter Malik is making in his answer here is that a lot of them turned around and just rented their land out to white people and got 1/12 of what they could have if they were to farm it themselves.
Okay.
So.
Well, so this Dawes Act started in 1887 per the National Archives.
Thank you, National Archives.
Thank you, National Archives. That's a good bona fide source right there.
Mark, should we do a whole episode on land allotment acts?
I really think so. We'll stir up the hornet's nest.
Yes. That's one of those topics that's a lot more controversial than you might think at first.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because land is passed down to people who currently own it. So,
yeah.
We'll just leave it right there for now.
Do that.
This will be your episode, Jeff.
Thank you, Mark. Mm-hmm. Number 12, the question is, tell me anything else of interest connected with your life. And he says, all are vagrants, not because they have not land, but because they have rented their places, hence obliged to roam. I regret to say that we have not any photographs of ourselves nor of home.
Wow. But so, yet they own that land.
Yeah, they don't have any photographs of it.
Yeah.
Sad. Or of themselves. I guess he didn't get a copy of his mugshot.
Yeah. So, one you want to remember right there.
Right, yeah. And that's, Mark, that's so many times that's the only photos we have about the people we talk about. So
that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Mark, why don't you tell us, let's go back and let's talk about number one, question number one, and that is, are you married, and if so, to whom? What's the answer, Mark?
The answer is, Jeff, that Mrs. Josie Malik, and she was born Josephine Gaddy in 1873 or 74. And like Peter, she is listed as being half French and half Nez Perce. But she was adopted as a baby, by Mr. Gaddy. And when he died, Josephine was raised by Evan and Ella Evans. Evan Evans?
Yep.
Of Grangeville.
Yeah. Evan Evans.
Somebody's parents were lazy. I got Evan Evans.
We have no clue.
But according to the news reporting at the time, although Peter himself gives the name William Gaddy as the person who adopted her.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what's going on there. Again, confusing genealogical records.
Sometimes it's a shit pile and you just got to sort through it the best you can to try and find a diamond.
Right you are, Mark.
You know.
I guess like that's a lot what we do is we put together pieces of puzzles that don't quite fit.
Yeah.
You know. But, you know, we try to present that to our audience, tell them, like, this is what this says, this is what that says. Decide for yourself, right?
Right. It's all you can do.
Yep. Right you are, Mark. Either way, Josie, as we'll call her, was lucky enough to receive a higher education. She attended Lewiston Normal School, which was the teacher college, and then went on to Whitman College up in Walla Walla and took some classes there. She returned to the Nez Perce Reservation to teach. Now, Josie was said to have been a very beautiful woman, according to the Idaho Statesman, on September 3rd, 1911. Quote, Miss Malik was quite successful as a teacher and became very popular all over the country. She was a very attractive woman, possessed of a charming personality and magnetism, and strangers rarely detected the fact that she had Indian blood in her veins.
Well, so, according to that Statesman article, before marrying Peter, Josie had been engaged to a white man and pressured by her adoptive family to marry him. But Josie, again, this is according to the newspaper reporting it, struggled with mixing races by marrying a white man. Again, quoting from the same article, it is said that Josephine Gaddy was at one time on the point of marrying a white man, but the old race problem stepped between them. The girl herself raised it and then gave up her dream of happiness. With the decision made, Josephine went back, not to her people, not to the full-blood Nez Perces, but to the thieving, drunken, cruel, and savage Malik, who seemed to combine all of the vices and meanness of the white and the redskins, with none of the virtues of either race. Her life with Malik, it is said, was a living hell. For he mistreated her and the three children as fast as they came into a world of squalor.
So, Mark, that quote brings up a point that even though natives had it hard, and that is understating it, people of mixed races had it even harder because they didn't really fit in with either group. Now, Mark, you often talk about the concept of othering, and this is the othering of the others. It also brings us to the next part of our story.
Yes. Yes, Jeff, it does. On July 2nd, 1911, Peter Malik committed a shocking crime. While allegedly on a drunken spree, while preparing for the 4th of July, he beat his wife, Josie, very severely. The newspaper reported that he struck Josie in the face with the butt of his shotgun. After Josie dropped to the ground, Peter kept up the attack, kicking her in the ribs and beating her without mercy, causing her collarbone and one arm to break. When Peter stopped hitting her, Josie begged for a glass of water. When Peter refused to bring one, Josie crawled to get it herself. As she was raising the cup to her lips, Peter kicked it out of her hands and continued the beating. As the beating continued, she blacked out.
When Josie woke up, Peter was gone, and she had to crawl to a nearby farm for help. When the neighbors got the doctor there, he counted 20 separate wounds on her head. Just on her head alone. One of the newspaper accounts mentioned that their three kids watched as their father beat their mother almost to death. And at the time, their kids were very young. They had a 2.5 girl named Rosalie, as well as a boy and girl twins named Marion Peter and Marie, who were just over a year old at the time. Josie's injuries were so grievous, and for some time, it was thought that she would die from her wounds. But while she was recovering, Peter was arrested.
Peter didn't deny nor admit to beating Josie and asked for his trial. He was charged with assault with intent to commit murder and taken to the jail at Lewiston. While he was being held at the Nez Perce County Jail, several inmates attempted to escape by cutting around a ventilator. They took twine from grocery packages, soaked it in lard, dipped it in quartz sand from the bricks of the jail, and twisted. This allowed it to be used as a cutting wire. And the inmates slowly cut away the steel holding the ventilator in place. The jail officers discovered the plot before the escape could be completed. It is unclear if Peter was involved, but it did occur in the section of jail where he was housed. Peter was assigned an attorney from Lewiston who filed a motion to dismiss the charges, claiming that the court did not have jurisdiction over the case because both the victim and aggressor were Native Americans.
Yeah, so as dumb as that might sound, this was actually not a bad idea. Now, jurisdiction in criminal cases involving Native American tribes, they can be super convoluted and confusing. Obviously, Mark, criminal justice is my area of study, but when I got to this part of the story, I had to look up how this would work. So, for example, some tribes have their own police and courts and jails, etc. They handle everything themselves, just as any sovereign nation would do. Other tribes partner with local law enforcement, while still others rely on the FBI, which they, all the way back to 1908, have been investigating crimes on reservations. And in turn, they use federal prosecutors to bring these cases to court. Also, on some reservations, it does depend on whether or not the suspect is from the tribe. So basically, it just all depends on the tribe itself and the agreements with the government. And I don't know. Does that make sense, Mark?
It does.
It makes sense that it's confusing.
It makes sense that it's confusing, but it makes sense that it depends on every tribe, and it could be one of basically three options. Yeah. But I'm curious which one the Nez Perce were, but we'll talk about
it. Right. And I did some looking into that, and I couldn't find anything specific. But I don't think their land was on the reservation, or it was considered to be off the reservation because they owned it as United States citizens. So,
yeah, because they had done the Dawes thing.
Right? Yeah, which makes it even more confusing.
So either way, the motion to dismiss was denied by Judge Steele. And the case against Peter Malik continued with a trial date being set for September 7th, 1911. Malik's attorney then argued for a change of venue because he felt that Peter could not get a fair trial because his story was the talk of the town. In fact, several death threats had been recorded against Malik since he had been arrested. During the last week of August, Judge Steele took the matter under advisement, but it seems he did not have a chance to rule on the motion because of what happened early the morning of September 1st, 1911.
Now, I think that is a wonderful time to take a quick commercial break, so why don't we do that, and we'll be right back after a word from our amazing sponsors. We appreciate the support of Tammy Guzman and her business, Advanced Services LLC. Advanced Services has the staff and services to empower people with developmental disabilities, provide them with enriching experiences, and enable them to build a strong foundation for themselves and their families. They offer service coordination, medical transportation, a center and community-based adult developmental therapy, and adult day health and supported living services. You can reach Advanced Services at 208-461-0438 or at their website, advancedservicesidaho.com. Advanced Services has offices in Nampa and Emmett to suit your needs.
Hey, Jeff, you remember that house in the Collister neighborhood of Boise we were looking into because of that sadistic priest that lived there?
Man, that's a crazy story, and that house is even crazier.
I was thinking about our friends at Birch Leaf Group, brokered by eXp Realty, and I was thinking, those ladies sure can sling a house. They could even sell the crazy priest house. Whether you have a gimp in the basement or a skin shack in the backyard. Kara Harwick and Melissa Call of Birch Leaf They can get your house sold and sold quick. Contact them at www.birchleafgroup.com or call them at 208-254-0490.
Hey, Mark, we should meet downtown for a cup of coffee.
We should, Jeff.
Where do you want to meet?
I'd like to go where we always go, Flying M Coffee House down in Boise.
Sounds like a good idea because Flying M Coffee House has been located on the corner of 5th and Idaho in downtown Boise since 1992, and they're currently celebrating their 30th anniversary.
I love it because the coffee house is renowned in the local community for its quirky furnishings, eclectic crowd, high-quality coffee, and unique gift shack. They are proud to be voted the best of Boise in the Boise Weekly for over a decade now.
It's awesome. Mark, how do we find them online?
Go to flyingmcoffee.com.
All right, that was a lovely commercial break, right, Mark?
It surely was, Jeff.
All right, where were we with the story?
Well, Peter Malik was arrested for beating his wife almost to death. There's that. And now he's sitting in the jail awaiting his trial while his attorney is trying everything he can do to get him out. Meanwhile, there were threats on Malik's life coming from the community, so plans were made to move Malik back to Lewiston for safekeeping. But on the morning of September 1st, 1911, those threats were carried out.
Around 2:30 a.m., a group of about 20 men approached the jail in Grangeville on foot, having left their horses some distance away to avoid alerting the jail officers of the approaching mob. Because of the threats, the sheriff saw fit to double the staffing in his jail, meaning there were two jailers on duty. When jailer Charles Waldrop heard a noise outside the jail, he went to investigate. As soon as he swung open the door, he found himself covered by several guns as a shout of, "Throw up your hands," was heard throughout the jail. Waldrop was bound and gagged, and his keys were taken from him. The mob pushed its way into the jail, where they found the other jailer, J.F. McLean, who had been sleeping near the cells. McLean attempted to slam the door between the main part of the jail and the cells, but the mob was too quick and prevented him from throwing the bolt.
After a couple of the vigilantes pushed Waldrop up against the wall, the rest rushed in and found the keys in the desk.
Oh, key control, Mark. Key control.
You gotta control the keys. The keeper of the keys. Mm-hmm. The electric lights were turned on, and someone started yelling Malik's name as the cells were searched. When they found him, a shout of, "Here he is, boys," rang out, and the mob rushed to his cell. The leader of the mob said, "Uncover your head, Pete, and take your medicine." When he realized what was happening, all he said was, "Take off those damn masks, you bleep." it was deleted in the newspaper's article. Yeah, and those were his last words.
They never leave the good words in the newspaper.
I know, right?
Yeah. So the vigilantes stuck their guns through the bars of the cell, and then someone counted to three before they unleashed a barrage of bullets into Peter Malik. When they were satisfied that the work was complete, they beat feet out of the jail and out to their awaiting horses. The jailers were able to free themselves, but when they attempted to alert the sheriff, they found that the telephone wasn't working. They go outside and find that the wires for the telephone had been cut. So once they did get a hold of the sheriff or got the sheriff there, they started investigating, looking around. The only trace of the mob were a couple of black masks left behind in the street in their hurry to get out of town. So when the coroner took possession of the body, he counted up to 11 bullet holes in Peter Malik's body. One was in the head, three near the heart, one in the abdomen, one in the groin, four in the arm, and one in the hand.
So the coroner's jury ruled that Peter Malik's death was caused by unknown persons, but also he exonerated the jailers from any wrongdoing.
Which I disagree with, but we'll save that.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Word traveled fast about the lynching of Peter Malik when Josie, who was still recovering from her wounds at the Evan Evans home, was told of Peter's death, she broke into tears but refused to make a statement. Newspapers as far away as Florida and newspapers as far away as Florida and Hawaii reported the story. When word reached Boise, Governor Hawley issued letters to Idaho County Sheriff John Overman and Judge Edgar Steele. His letter to the sheriff was very critical of the jail deputies who failed to protect their prisoner, hinting his belief that they were either in on the lynching or were not brave enough to carry out their duties. And that's the term they used, lynching, even though he was shot.
Yeah.
Lynchings can be more than just hanging somebody.
That's what the, you know, that's what the popular image, the popular image of a lynching is a hanging, but basically lynching is any kind of mob action that results in a death, I think is how you would have defined that.
Well, and so Governor Hawley said the proper thing to do would have been to fight the mob, even at risk to their own lives.
So, Mark, I kind of have a problem with that, with what Hawley says. You know, being a correctional officer for a long time, yeah, we have a duty to protect our prisoners, our inmates. But at the same time, number one goal is to go home at the end of the night. So,
right.
I don't know.
Well, they knew what this dude did. There was solid evidence that he beat the crap out of a poor defenseless woman in front of her children with a shotgun.
Right.
He didn't even give her a chance. He hit her in the face with a shotgun. So it's kind of like, and this is probably more my opinion than others, but it's like if I'm a jailer and I have a whole mob of guys that I know, and they want to get in, I'll try a little bit to resist. But, man, I don't think I'd do that.
Right.
Yeah. You go ahead, Governor Hawley, and get your political ass in the way. Right. You know what I mean? Anyway.
Like, you know, he's too busy bowling in the basement of his house to...
Well, was it that guy?
That was Hawley, right?
No, it was James Brady.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The Brady House. Yep.
Yeah, Brady House down.
Oh, the Brady Bunch.
Oh, yeah. In the banker Eoff's house at 2nd and Main in Boise.
Next to the SA office.
Yeah, right there.
So Hawley's message to Judge Steele urged that the jurist call a grand jury to investigate the matter. So he said, lynching under any circumstances is a disgrace to the state and especially to the county wherein it occurs. But lynching with yesterday's attending circumstances is absolutely unbearable, as this man, as I understand it, had already been before the courts and his trial was being prepared for. I cannot tell whether there was any real effort made to protect him or not, but I presume there was. Now, Governor Hawley also issued a $1,000 reward for the opposition for the apprehension of the guilty men to be drawn from state funds. Now, $1,000 was the maximum that he could offer under the law.
You know, as an aside from this story, but related, I'm thinking, you know, okay, there's one thought in my mind that this guy, his story relates similarly to at least the violent action of one Charles Sandusky, a criminal that was also housed at the old pen for stabbing his wife 28 times.
Yeah.
It's on Behind Gray Walls. It's a good podcast. But he got out and was paroled for good behavior. He almost killed the woman, and she was, you know, she was pregnant with his child at the time that he stabbed her in 1917, Glens Ferry. And he got out after just, I don't know, goes in 1917, 1918, and he gets out in like 23 or so.
Yeah.
And, you know, good thing his son shot him in the face. His nose was blown off. But then he went to the hospital, but his son didn't trust that he would leave because, you know, he went back after his wife, who had since remarried.
Was he pardoned for the crime? Or
paroled?
He was paroled.
Paroled. Okay. I didn't know there was a difference, but I'm a layman.
So parole, you're still basically under supervision of the state. Pardon, if you're pardoned, that's it. Like, yeah, the state has nothing else to say about you.
He was paroled.
Yeah.
Okay. And so he was going to get on a train from McCammon. It's an Idaho town in the east, southeast. But she had been there, but he gets on a train and his son shoots him 5 times on that train, 6 times. with a 44. He wanted to make sure, and the kid got off, Floyd Sandusky, because he's like, he's made it known that he's going to come back. And so, you know, I mean, I've run into quite a few stories of men who committed violent crimes where if the person had died, it would have been way worse.
Yeah.
But they didn't, and so they get off rather easy. So I'm not saying it's all right to take law into your own hands, but at the same time, I bet this is running through those guys' heads, you know.
And we're definitely going to get into that kind of discussion, Mark. But yeah, like, actually, let's get into that. Let's talk about that here in a second.
Okay, but if county officials didn't act, we're getting back to the main theme here. Yes. But if they didn't act, Holly was prepared to send his attorney, a general, to look into the matter. If the state didn't act, the federal government was ready to act. The Nez Perce tribe, however, was a bit more melancholy in the matter. Since Peter Malik had essentially traded his membership in the tribe for his land, he was no longer a government ward or a tribe member. The general feeling among the tribe was that Malik was a bad character and that he got what he deserved. That sentiment was echoed by one of the guards from the pen, calling Malik a bad Indian, who behaved well enough behind bars, but upon being released, he relapsed into his old, brutal way of living.
Okay. But in response to Governor Hawley's letter to Judge Steele, the judge wrote back, blaming the Idaho Board of Pardons for the lynching. And this is what we're getting to, Mark. His argument was basically that the courts could sentence a man to prison only for that man to be released by the pardon board well before his sentence ran out, potentially sending violent criminals back into the community. Now, Mark, like you just said, give us a good example of there's quite a few times where we'll be researching a story and the man, usually man, almost always a man.
Yeah, pretty much.
was given like a, say, a 20, 25 year sentence, but he was released by the pardon board after 2-3 years. And it always blows my mind, especially as someone who worked for the Idaho Department of Corrections for 13 years, not to mention that my uncle did a couple of stints on the pardon and parole board himself. It just surprises me that this can happen, because it doesn't happen today. Like if you have a 20-year sentence, you're going to do probably at least 10 or 15 of it because of the mandatory minimum sentencings. And, you know, there's a lot more that we could go into on that, but, you know, it's kind of a shock to see that when we see that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was the one where actually murder was committed in 1935 in downtown Eagle at the Eagle Hotel. This man, Cecil Ray, was arrested for shooting a C.O. Leem, a Korean gardener that had a little garden he'd sell vegetables in the area around Eagle. But anyway, he basically was gambling one night at the pool hall, and he didn't like losing, and so he whipped out his gun. Everybody else left, but C.O. Leem was like, I won. I want my money. And so Cecil Ray shot him, dragged him behind the bank there, behind the Eagle Bank, which is still there, an Italian restaurant. Yeah. And then he went to sleep in the hotel. He was convicted and given like 25 years, but they paroled him
right after
only a few. Their argument was, well, you know, he's worthy of a second shot. Now, there's a lot.
Shoot him again.
Right. Right. Exactly. And this guy got away literally with murder.
Yeah.
And the judge and lawyer in the case were like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Why are you doing that? Like, you can't let him out. But I think to a lot of people, he was a Korean guy. You know, but and just yeah. It makes me think about Anthony McBride, right?
Right.
He got what I think probably by that time period he deserved. But a lot of people were like, well, why is he getting away with he just shot it as quote unquote Chinaman. Right. And I thought it was an Indian, right, quote unquote.
Yeah.
You know, it's weird how that happened then and like law and order prevailed.
Yeah. He was hung.
Yeah. But in 1935, we always think of like, oh, all the racist shit happened back in 1860s. But no, it happened way after.
So here's my thought on Anthony McBride. And you, if you all haven't read our book, Murder, Mayhem, and Boise, like, his full story is in there. But basically, he was drunk, and he shot a, like Mark said, a Chinese person who thought it was a Native American. But there was a feeling that, at the time, that no man could be hung by the government in southern Idaho. And so I think Anthony McBride was almost made an example of in his case. Yeah. So it was the government saying, look, we have control. We can protect you. Let's hang this dude and you'll see that'll happen.
Sure. You know, but the weird thing was, maybe not weird, maybe just, but I was expecting, you know, when Anthony McBride outside of Weezer, right, rides into this camp and says, oh, I see those two guys laying there, those engines laying there, and the guys tell him he's a Chinaman, right? Mm-hmm. That they wouldn't do anything to stop him or at least arrest him. And they did. They're like, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
History is confusing people. We like to generalize a time period, right? But
and just to be safe, we're talking about the 1870s, right?
1868.
Yeah.
And we have the court transcripts too, mm-hmm, that we found after the fact, but Jeff used a lot of, some of that, I think. Yeah. And anyway.
Mostly newspaper reporting on that one.
But it's just these things happen. Mm-hmm. And so some of the reasons that vigilante committees or, you know, mobs occurred is because the law didn't work so many times. So I'm not saying it's okay to have a mob and do that, but still.
There was a perception that the government or the courts didn't do what they could to protect the citizens.
Well, but this happens in 1911 what we're talking about on this episode specifically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you had bona fide courts and stuff. So in the earlier years, it made sense because there was less of a solidified government. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't, this is a future episode too, vigilante law, yeah, and law definitely. Violence.
But yeah, I'm like, it's completely weird. 1911 seems so late to me for this kind of thing to happen. This was like, a lot of historians say about the turn of the century, 1900 was the close of the Old West. But this is definitely an Old West story a decade later.
You know? Oh, yeah. So. Yeah, you know, and I mean, we have a story, another, actually, it didn't make it in our book because they cut it because another book had something similar. But we're talking about the shootout at the
Free Roll Saloon,
yeah, where a guy that we've talked about before, Jimmy Turner, yeah, he got what he probably deserved because he was always picking fights, and I guess the guy could only fight women because Billy Gilbert was a badass, but he was quiet badass. You know, he's the kind of guy that can really kick somebody's ass.
Yeah.
Because he's quiet and he doesn't act like he can. And he shot him dead when he threatened him, and he got off too.
Yep.
You know, that was 1894. So it's like, I don't know, close of the Old West, you know? I don't know.
No, definitely.
Yeah. But
it's one of those subjective things.
But anyway, that's a good conversation. We'll have plenty more on that. But to get back to Peter Malik, he was buried in Grangeville at Prairie View Cemetery. However, it seems that no one ever collected the $1,000 reward for his murder. It is also unknown, you know, if a grand jury was ever called or if the state or feds investigated the crime at all. None of the Grangeville vigilantes were ever brought to justice. And unlike Boise or Payette vigilantes, which we will talk about later, there was never even any speculation as to who these men were.
Yeah, for example, we're pretty sure that one of the lead vigilantes in the Boise area was A.J. Reynolds, the publisher of the Statesman, right?
Yeah.
So, of course, we know who the leader of the Payette vigilantes was. Yeah. It's McConnell.
Future governor of the state of Idaho, right? Yeah. William McConnell.
Yeah, so I don't really know that there was. It seems like there's a lot of hubbub about the killing at first, and you know, there's a lot of talk about investigating and finding out who these people were, and then as public interest faded, so did the investigations, that type of thing. You know,
sure, not a need for it, I guess. After
happens
that,
all the time, right?
Right. Happens now, like in a day.
Yeah. So eventually, Josie recovered from her grievous wounds, and she was able to raise her children out on the Malik farm. And Mark, I didn't mention where this farm was, did I?
I don't think so, Jeff.
All right, so if you go straight north from Grangeville, and you go east from Cottonwood, and then kind of where those two lines would meet up, that's where their farm was.
I actually know that.
Yeah, so that, yeah.
My wife was born in Cottonwood by nuns. They birthed her.
They birthed her?
Yeah, the ones from up on that pretty church up in the...
Yeah. There's never a nun around that I need one.
It's none of your business, Jeff.
So... Yeah, so Josie became an active member in the community. She served as the president of the Columbus Club, which I couldn't figure out what that was. Not the Columbia Club, because I know what that is. The Columbus Club. No idea what that was.
I don't know. I just know that I'm a member of the Friends of Magellan.
Great, yes.
Yeah. We don't like Chris.
I'm more of an America Vespucci fan myself.
Oh, wow, that's fancy dancing.
Yes. So the Malik kids, they grew up with their mother between the family farm and a home they had in Grangeville. Sadly, though, they didn't fare too much better. The children didn't fare too much better than their father in life. So Marion, the boy, one of the twins, he spent most of his adult life in and out of jail. His twin sister, Marie, her life was almost as tragic as her parents. So her first husband, a guy named Wallace Claw, was killed in a car accident in 1937 when Marie was 26 years old. Fast forward just 4 years later, Marie was in a relationship with a man named David Wall. On July 6, 1941, Wall shot Marie in the head at her home, and then returned to his own home where he shot himself in the head. And he left a note reading, "If anything happens to me or my girlfriend, Marie Claw, give a cheap funeral."
Oh, shit.
Right? "Sell my car and my property and take care of it." And, you know, sadly, it was Josie who found Marie's body.
Well, Josie passed away at age 75 on January 23rd, 1949. She shares a headstone with her husband in the Prairie View Cemetery in Grangeville.
Which, Mark, that brings up a good point for me. She lived the rest of her life using the Malik name. You know, her husband, Peter, obviously was dead, long dead by that point. She could have moved on and changed her name back to her maiden name or used a different name, but she didn't. She chose to be known as Malik for the rest of her life. And I don't know what that says about her. Maybe I'm speculating too much, but maybe she still loved Peter. Maybe she didn't think what Peter did was all that bad. She was certainly, you know, I don't know. It's hard to say, like, domestic violence brings out weird things in people. I've seen that myself personally. And yeah. So what do you think about this story, Mark?
Well, I think that there's quite a bit, I think. But I can say that her using his name, maybe it was expedient for her. Maybe it brought a certain level of respect. Maybe, oh, she's the one who survived that. Yeah. She's, but, you know, also, you know, my wife deals with abuse a lot in her job, not, you know, with people who are in abusive relationships. And I know there's like, that's the damnable part about it is these people's, they get, the women most every time get beat and abused, and it's hard to leave because they love these people. And there's like almost like a Stockholm syndrome kind of thing going on. I know, like, again, back to the Idaho State Pen, old Idaho State Pen. But when we're talking about, the guy who jumped off Van Vlack,
yeah. Jumped off the
top of the cell house.
Third level?
Yeah, right. From a beam in cell house, the 1890 cell house. Mm-hmm. Yeah, his wife, who he had beat and beat and beat, every time she could turn him in, she was worried about him.
Yeah.
And he eventually killed her, and then he was going to be executed, but he jumped off the top of this, you know, beam in the house and landed on his face. He probably should have just gotten hanged.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, Mildred Hook, that was her name. But just sound like very sweet. She sounded like a very sweet, wonderful woman, and she ends up, you know, love killed her. Well, this guy killed her, but, you know. I also think some of these guys have loved the women like they do.
Yeah.
Like they're, but obviously it's.
Yeah, it's hard for us to look into that relationship and make judgments on it and say, oh, that's, it's this situation or that situation. But, you know, like I've said, like I used to be a police officer and I would go to the same house over and over again. And it was always get this bastard out of my house. And then the next time it was, oh, I love him. You know, I love that bastard. And, you know, so it's, like I said, it's hard to put judgments on that situation. And there's a whole, actually, there's a whole, remember there's a cycle that they teach in domestic violence classes where it's like the honeymoon phase and then the building towards violence and then the violence and then it goes back to the honeymoon phase and it just keeps cycling over and over and over.
I can unequivocally say that laying hands on a woman, anybody but a woman, is wrong.
Yeah.
Very wrong.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's one thing like, so, you know, I mean, there's a primal side of me that was like Peter Malick was shot. I'm like, yeah, well, that's what you get, man.
Yeah.
You know.
No, but, exactly. And I think it was kind of this perfect storm of who he was and who Josie was, because Josie was obviously really respected in the community for being a teacher and for being an educated native. And, or, you know, and then even further than that, like it's a racial thing where, you know, she was obviously seen as more of a white person than a native. He was seen more as a native than a white person, even though they were both mixed race. So it's kind of this weird dynamic that brought all these circumstances together and ended up in that violent action of Peter being shot to death.
And that's another thing, you know, you get a lot of domestic violence in situations where people are drunk. People are in dire straits.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of hardship. And I'm not saying it doesn't happen all over the place, but, you know, you wonder, like, how much of this would have been alleviated had his circumstances and her circumstances been easier.
Sure.
What if she had married that white guy?
Yeah.
Maybe she would have had a much happier life. Probably would have.
Maybe.
I don't know, but, you know, it wasn't just the white side of things. It was like, we don't want race mixing. There were people, as her words were, people on that side too, the Nez Perce side, the tribes, different tribes. I'm sure it was all over the place.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, so these things are complicated, so I'm sure we'll get ripped apart for this. But great, honest conversations. We're all right with that. The majority are cool.
That's why we do what we do.
We do, right? If we're not pissing somebody off, Jeff, we're not doing our job.
Mark, did you have anything else on the episode itself? Do you want to talk about vigilante justice right now, or should we save that for our other episodes?
I think we should leave most of it for the other episodes, but America has had a long history of vigilante justice. You know, I mean, we're not the only country, definitely, but mob violence is a big part of America's story.
Yeah.
And it could take... Definitely out in California, you know, cattle theft, horse theft, those kind of things, you know, going and hanging somebody for the crime and not the way they looked definitely happened all the time.
Yep. Range wars.
Range wars. Yeah, all that. You had quite a few, you know, Mexican citizens, Mexican-Americans that were hanged. Because they were Mexican-American. You had in this state, you had some Chinese miners that were hanged outside of what was it?
Warren.
Yeah. Okay. And that was an extrajudicial hanging.
Justice. They call it justice, but I don't know if you can call something justice where you don't have the mechanism in place.
Yeah. And then you had, and let's just not beat around the bush on this one, you had the single number one most targeted group were, well, black men. Down south for sure, especially in the 19-teens, 20s, 30s.
Yeah.
You know, even it started to go away in the 1930s, and I'm not an expert right now to say why exactly, but, you know, and these, a lot of these were seen in the Midwest, you know? in Illinois, Indiana for sure. And so, you know, there's a lot of American history people don't want to face up to in, you know, interwoven into the history of lynchings.
Right. If you want to make yourself sick to your stomach, go on the Wikipedia page for lynching and just go through all the photos on there. It's just
disgusting. People, well, people collected those things.
Postcards.
Postcards. Even pieces of clothing or people themselves were collected at these lynchings. And so...
They're trophies, basically.
They were trophies. Yeah. And it kind of goes to show how the people being lynched, in many cases African-American people, how they were looked at. They were looked at less than human, but not quite animal. Mm-hmm. And you know, where many would kind of be aghast at taking a white person's body part.
Right.
Or piece of bloody clothing. That's what they did to African Americans who were lynched.
Yeah. So I think in Idaho, we were kind of insulated from a lot of that. Fortunately, I mean, there was certainly racial violence. There was maybe not as, I mean, there weren't any out and out lynchings of African Americans. I found an article while I was researching this story saying that there was no recorded lynchings of Native Americans, but we just spent an hour talking about how that's not true.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. There is Tom Biago, but he shot a white man in cold blood and admitted to it. He said, you know, his cousin, I believe, had been shot in 1878, mm-hmm. war, time of war in Idaho.
Yeah.
The Bannock War. And he was pissed and he admitted it. And he went up and he said, I'm tired of this and all this that I've seen of my people. And he went up and shot an innocent white man.
Yeah.
And he hanged for it.
And that was...
So it wasn't so much a lynching as it was...
He did have a trial and all that.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah,
that's not really a lynching per se because it was part of the legal process. But wasn't he hanged like near where... The old pen is now.
Yeah, from what I've read and heard, I think on Behind Gray Walls,
hi, not the Indian Sky.
I believe it was right where, kind of in the general area of the old territorial cell block, which was is now the burnt out one you walk in. That's the oldest first one that was there, so it's right around there. And obviously, it was probably in the yard there because they would keep them in the yard of the prison house. Oh. And it was just that block or that, yeah, that block of the old territorial pen with a wall around it, right?
Right.
And a garden and all that. And it was probably somewhere in there. It would be my educated guess when you walk in through the admin building. But there is a lot of controversy over the painting and the murals that are inside the old Ada County Courthouse, mm-hmm. right? And... I still think it's kind of BS that you depict a hanging up there.
Right.
Because it's not like you're going to take a white guy and depict his hanging up there.
Right.
But yet they have Tom Biago up there about to be hanged.
Right.
It's always covered by some sort of banner or something.
There was a judge that ordered it be covered. Like, okay. So the article that I'm talking about where it said there's no recorded lynching of Native Americans, it was about those murals. And it said that a judge had ordered it to be covered up.
But, you know, the other thing about Peter Malik is, did they do it because he was Native American?
Exactly.
I mean, I can't say no. I can't say yes. They probably, would they have done this to a white guy? A lot of history says they might have.
Right.
They probably would have.
Yeah.
But maybe they wouldn't have. I don't know.
Who knows?
Never know.
But the, you know, going back to the whole... Putting it on the shoulders of the pardon board, though, like, anyway, there were several cases where men had done violent crimes from, you know, Nez Perce County up there, gotten out of prison a couple years after they went in, went on to commit more violent acts. So the community definitely had a reason to feel like they needed to protect themselves. Whether Peter Malik was a threat to the whole community, there was another allegation that he had taken a shot at one of his neighbors for nothing. But again, like, you try to corroborate any of these stories from the old newspapers, it's hard to say what actually happened and what didn't.
It is. I mean, that's the world we work in.
So, Mark, you were talking about people being pissed off at us earlier and such. So I'm going to leave you with a few minutes here at the end to talk about that.
Well, there are some friends of mine that have podcasts or whatnot or do other social media type things. And every once in a while, they will kind of address their critics. And most of the time I'm like, if you do it nicely and say nice things or not nice things, just say why you disagree. All right. You know, hey, we're not here for everybody. We're here for the people that like what we do. And if you don't like it, well, hey, you don't have to listen. But if you want to give us a review and you don't like it, well, then that's your prerogative. But sometimes people just tend to cross the line. And so I would like to reply to a certain person calling himself on Apple Podcasts, the Town Noob. The Town Noob says, I got turned on to this podcast when I heard Jeff on another podcast I was listening to, and they gave him the opportunity to talk about Ida history. I checked out his website and saw that they, I'm guessing this is your Astonishing Legends.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is cool because you're wearing the hoodie right now.
Happen to be.
Yeah, yeah. But I checked out his website and saw that they, Jeff and his business partner Mark, offer walking tours of Boise and Nampa. I then found they had since started a podcast. I was excited, blah, 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 the mysterious history of the state I've called home for the past 20 years. Then enter Mark. The ridiculous accents and constant middle school sexual innuendos make this podcast almost unbearable to listen to. It is painful to listen to with Mark's constant incessant blabbering, but I am really interested in the subject matter. Initially, prior to starting the podcast, I was going to approach my wife about taking the walking tours they offer, but I think I'd like to stay married. They even have a book out that I'm afraid to buy because of Mark. My hope is that either Mark realizes this platform is not the place for his banter and social views, or Jeff ditches the anchor and gets to the task at hand. Well, cheers to you, Jeff.
Thank you. Thank you.
My response, my rebuttal.
Wait, can I say something before we start?
Oh, yeah, please. Go ahead.
Mark, you and I would not be where we're at without our partnership.
Yes.
And you're probably going to cover this, but like, we both had our own thing before we got together. It was, you know, we had a little success apart from each other. But once we got together, we gained so much ground together. So,
oh, yeah.
And I kind of hate how this Town Noob says that it's, you know, my website and not Mark and Jeff's. Like, it's our thing together. Like, we've been doing this now for, what, almost 3 years? So,
yeah. All right. We've thank you.
Take off on it, Mark.
Oh no, I appreciate that. I actually talk about that, but yeah, that's true. So, dear Town Noob, why don't you go and make your own podcast instead of telling us how ours should be? You have the right to speak your mind, and I have the right to tell you that you come across as entitled. Jeff and I will decide what is right for our platform that we created, not you. What is more, I make plenty of people laugh and I have fun telling my jokes. Your opinions are subjective to your views and values, and since this is a free country, I will speak my mind and tell my jokes. And many listeners probably disagree with you, so don't listen. I know I don't want you to. I am overjoyed that you do not want to go on a tour. It would be uncomfortable for you to be surrounded by people having a good time and laughing at my jokes. You might feel out of place. Finally, Jeff and I don't need you to buy our book. We've done really well without you, and we will continue to do so. So I am going to continue to contextualize history with my good friend Jeff. Do you think you can just suggest Jeff ditch the anchor and he'll do it? Do you think he agrees with you about what the task at hand is? And also, posting anonymously lacks conviction. Additionally, use some specific examples while insulting somebody. It helps add gravitas to your argument. So, good day to you, sir. I say, good day.
All right. Good response, Mark. You know, I think, you know, the humor, like, we're going to throw humor into this stuff. Like, it's hard to talk about a dude getting shot to death in a jail cell without joking around a little bit.
Yeah.
And no one wants to hear it. It's just like, and this happened on this date and this time, and then that happened later on.
Well, Town Noob did.
I mean, apparently that's what he wants to hear.
Yeah.
Well, obviously we're not the show for Town Noob.
No. So, see you, noob.
Bye,
noob. Later.
See ya.
Should I read the other one or leave that one?
I think we're good there, Mark. I think people get that we're going to do our thing. If you like it, listen. If you don't, don't.
Well, let me just say this, okay? I want to end and just say there's a guy, Cornerstone 1976. He leaves a good criticism. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with it at all, but he does say he likes it. And sometimes we just talk past each other. It's okay. It happens when people listen to things. Yeah. So we actually, I just want to say to you, if you're listening, I have no problem with Lincoln. I know Jeff doesn't. We are more joking because the archives have so many Lincoln books.
Yeah.
Lincoln is probably, there are a lot of important figures in American history. He is top five for sure, yes. Maybe top two. Great man, right man for the moment. And it's more a slam at the controlling powers at the archives than it is to Lincoln. Yeah. So no disrespect to Lincoln. And I also want to say that I have no problem with the great men in history. I am just more interested in social history. So that kind of goes against the people who lived under the administrations of great men, worked for the businesses of great men, and as we frequently are seeing, great women are being included in this too. So I think both need to be studied. And I would like to say also that I know John Brown. I know who he was. I am not this woman that you went to school with. You know, and I think both of your focuses of study are important. You know, John Brown's important. So are, as we put it, let's see, queer subculture in the 19th century of America. You know, I mean, that hasn't been studied either. So she could very well say that, you know, you don't know anything about that. And John Brown does. But here's the thing. I appreciate the way you said this. I don't think I'm a neo-Marxist. And the thing about Walla Walla, you know, I'm pretty much speaking directly to this one person. The thing about their claims that gold was actually found by Chinese miners first, but they were too smart and went back to Walla Walla. Jeff said that too smart part. And here's the thing. It's a joke.
Yeah.
It's a joke.
It's a joke.
But also it's not a joke because it was really freaking dangerous where Grimes found gold, evidenced by the fact that he was shot and died where he found gold. And he's buried up there still. So that is kind of a valid claim.
You know,
also, that source about them being found, that gold being found first by Chinese miners, is in A Chinaman's Chance, The Chinese on the Rocky Mountain Mining Frontier, and it focuses on gold and Chinese in the Boise Basin. And it's by Dr. Li Ping Shu, got his doctorate at New Mexico University, and it's a fantastic book. I suggest you pick it up and see what I'm talking about. But respect to you, sir.
Yes. Thank you for your more constructive criticism, anyway. We are not doing this because we don't welcome criticism. We like civil discourse as well. And, you know, I don't know what to say about that other than that.
No. I mean, you know, if somebody leaves a message that, you know, the public can view and it's polite,
yeah,
you know, sometimes it's worthy of a debate. He said, Cornerstone said that he liked our podcast and it was good. Thank you. Yes. I just wanted to address what you commented on, but with the respectful tone. Town Noob, you didn't bring any respect. You didn't bring any evidence. You didn't say anything specific other than you didn't like my jokes. That's fine. See you later.
Mark, I think, you know, with the Lincoln thing, I'm more critical of Lincoln than you are. So I kind of feel bad that you got the crap from that.
Yeah, know? Man. Well, it's just because apparently I'm a neo-Marxist, and
yeah,
I think that the working classes will rise up and, you know, claim the leadership roles from the bourgeoisie.
And again, I'm the one that works for a union, so.
Hey, yeah, the prison guard union.
Mm-hmm, yep.
Okay. All right.
Anyway, so with that, Mark, you got anything else?
No, I thought it was a good, vibrant, fun discussion.
Excellent. All right. Well, we'll be back next week with another fantastic episode and some corny-ass jokes, so.
And tuberculosis is on the table, folks. Just more, more of that. A whole helping.
All right. Wash your hands, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's County.
He said, quote, lynching under any circumstances is a disgrace to the state and especially to the county wherein it occurs. But lynching with yesterday's attending circumstances.
But lunching a man? Did they eat him afterwards?
They ate him for lunch. Nice little Lunchable packed up in that cell.
Nice. Crackers.
Try it.